From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 18th day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Don't forget that tomorrow is Agronomy Day here on campus. I'll start dispatching the wagons into the field from the South Farms. That's just to the south and the east of the Assembly Hall. At 7 a.m., we hope to see you there. Later on in this program, second half hour, which we call the Farming World, we'll talk with Joe Spencer. He'll be one of the researchers in the field. We'll take a look at what he's been doing with the Western corn rootworm and go over all the details of how it adapted in this region to the crop rotation producers were using. That happens in the second half hour of the program. In the first half hour, of course, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois, get an update from the Pro Farmer Crop Tour, and we'll discuss the agricultural cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Oh, and Drew Lerner will be here, too, to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago, on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby September wheat at $6.56, the settlement price up a nickel for the day. December at 688 and three quarters for the soft red, five higher, and the March at 709 and three quarters, three and three quarters higher. September lead option in the hard red from Kansas City at $6.85, up 8 cents. September corn futures back in Chicago, $4.18 and a half, the old crop at three and three quarters higher. New crop December futures, $4.33 and a quarter, up 3 1/4, and the March corn, $4.46, 2 1/2 cents higher. May futures at $4.52 and three quarters, up 2 for the day. And the December contract of next year at $4.39 and three quarters, down 3/4 of a cent. September soybean futures a dime lower at $10.35 and a quarter. November at $10.30 and three quarters, up, or rather down 11 1/4. And January soybeans at $10.37 and a half, 11 cents lower. The March contract settled $10.40 and a quarter, down a dime for the day. September bean meal at $3.07.40, 90 cents higher. September bean oil at $40.86, down 73. Livestock numbers, August futures and live cattle at $97.20, $1.57 and a half higher. August feeders at $113.70, up 45 cents. And October lean hogs, $78.07 and a half, up $2.55. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures for the day. September contract, $75.38 a barrel, down 39 cents. September ethanol at $1.82 and 7 tenths, up 2 2/10. And the natural gas for the day at $4.22 and a half, down 4 2/10 of a cent. September heating oil, diesel fuel, at $2.02 and 4 tenths of a cent. That's just about 1/10 of a cent lower. And the gold futures on the afternoon, up $3.10 at $1,229.70 an ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, now just about 49 points higher at 10,454. And the U.S. dollar for the day at 82.22 is down 0.07 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for Urbana-Champaign looks like at this hour from the National Weather Service. They say partly sunny skies today. Today, that is, high near 83, east-southeast winds around 6 miles an hour. Then tonight should be partly cloudy with a low of 61, east-southeast winds between 3 and 5 miles an hour. Thursday, mostly sunny skies, a high near 88. Calm winds becoming out of the south-southwest around 5 miles an hour. Then tomorrow night, partly cloudy, a low of 67, 3 to 5 mile an hour for the wind. Friday, partly sunny, a high of 90 degrees, winds out of the southeast at 6 to 10 miles an hour. And Friday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Mostly cloudy, a low around 69 degrees. The extended forecast says Saturday should have a 30% chance of thunderstorms as well. A high near 89, a low of 69 degrees and partly cloudy Saturday evening. And on Sunday, it'll be sunny with a high of 88 degrees Sunday night. Mostly clear, a low around 65 degrees. We'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City when we get to the bottom of the hour here on the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tom Testale in Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Wednesday edition of the Closing Mark Report. A couple of notes. Make sure that you do come in tomorrow for Agronomy Day on the South Farms here in Urbana-Champaign. I'll be dispatching the wagons into the field starting at about 7 a.m. in the morning. Agronomy Day, your opportunity to see the kinds of research the U of I professors have been doing all year long. Ask them questions and probably give them some ideas about the research you'd like to have them do in the future. It's free and starts at 7 o'clock in the morning. There are four tours, so you need to arrive early. Also, don't forget, tomorrow's move-in day on campus, so while you're coming in at 7 in the morning, and it probably won't be a problem, you might want to avoid Lincoln Avenue as you depart the afternoon from Agronomy Day. Again, that starts at 7 o'clock. And don't forget, there are a couple of other things. Tonight at the Shelby County Senior Center, Dave Dickey will be there, along with Matt Bennett and Pete Manhart and Sherm Newland and Wayne Nelson to take up one of our ag panels. Dinner's at 6. The Outlook panel is at 7 o'clock. That's in Shelbyville this evening at the Shelby County Senior Center, 325 East North 9th Street. Starts at 7 o'clock. The Outlook panel, of course, is free and open to all. And then he'll be in El Paso tomorrow. You can find out all about that on our website at willag.org. Let's talk about the agricultural futures markets. On the phone line with us from his office in Oakland, Illinois, is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Todd.
What'd you think of the marketplace today?
Well, it was very unusual. There was something in there for everybody. The big drop in the soybean prices started last night and went on through the day, rebounded pretty good, and then closed a little lower. A couple things, Dan Bassey was on CNBC. You could see a different tone in Dan, and of course, with the potash, the grain prices, the world ag economy. It was interesting to listen to him. Also, from the behavioral economics school, we had more phone calls, more concern, a little more nervousness in the phone. And then from our crop tour people that are on the tour, a lot of variability. They're seeing a lot of sudden death in Iowa and the soybeans. And I think the variability on the Indiana and Illinois corn crop was also noted. And then when my private forecasters emphasized 10 days of basically no rain for a big part of the eastern corn belt, that also puts a little fear in everybody. So there was a lot of rebalancing the portfolio. The day before it was in wheat, and of course today was in soybeans.
Yeah, Bossy has historically been a little to the bearish side. Are you telling me he turned a bit
more friendly?
I think
he's a little more conservative in that, and he said, he's basically talking about the Soviet situation, the Russian situation, and of course he said that if everybody in the world had the food intake of the typical U.S. citizen, it'd take three globes to feed them. And, of course, he was bullish farmland, potash, did also talk about a little better tone as far as price levels were concerned.
Yeah, and then on the potash thing, that was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. It looks like they're looking to purchase the Canadian Potash Corporation. I forget what the actual name of that, but it's the one that operates in Canada. And our own Emerson Napsicker from the University of Illinois was quoted in that, if you go far enough into the article. Kind of fun to see his name there. But they're looking like they're thinking that the rest of the world's going to come up and fertilizer is going to be in great demand.
Well, part of the key of being a successful Central Illinois farmer is, number one, have good farmland, have it well-drained, put the right seed in, of course, keep the fertilizer level up. And, of course, the amount of fertilizer U.S. farmers use compared to the rest of the world is, we're in the lead. But in order to get those yields, fertilizer's in demand. And, of course, that's one reason why I think people are buying potash companies.
And Pro Farmers out on their tour, they've been reporting back some variability, but still awfully good crops to this point, although they were a little disappointed, I think, in parts of Illinois that they've been through.
Yeah, the one man that was on the Indiana tour basically indicated a lot of variability, good soybean pod counts, but it needs rain, very dry. Also, he isn't quite as friendly as, you know, as optimistic on the corn as, you know, what came out of that meeting.
What do you think between now and the real start of harvest in your part of the world? What will the markets stay steady? Can they manage to stay at these levels?
Oh, I think they're going to be very strong, and I think the big factor is the nervousness is with this, you know, drier forecast. I think we're going to see bushels evaporate. Anytime it's usually an early harvest, that's a bad sign, and variability is also another key.
Anything else you want to add before I let you go?
Have a profitable day.
Hey, you too. Thanks much, Paul. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Wednesday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
If you're looking for a way to go ask questions about commodities, you can do that tonight if you're in the Shelbyville area at the Shelbyville County Senior Center. It's on 325 East North Street, East North 9th Street, that is, in Shelbyville. Matt Bennett will be there along with Pete Manhart, Sherm Newland, and Wayne Nelson, our own Director of Ag Programming. Dave Dickey will head up the panel. That's tonight, starts at 7, and it's free. Speaking of Dave, he's here now. He'll take us through the agricultural news for the afternoon.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. On Friday afternoon, you can listen to Commodity Week. Chip Flory will be our guest. He's on the Pro Farmer Crop Tour this week and heads that up, in fact. If you'd like to get the latest information directly from them, you can do that at agweb.com. That's AGWEB.com, agweb.com. Chip has been out on the road in Nebraska after a record-setting Nebraska corn crop in 2009. He says, of course, there are high expectations again for this year. And after 2 days of scouting fields, the crop tour leader, Flory, estimates the corn yield there is steady with a year ago at 0.3% below last year.
Last year, Nebraska yielded 178 bushels per acre. To me, with the stress that some of this dryland crop has been under, it's going to be hard-pressed to get to 178 bushels per acre, which would match last year's. And it's going to be really hard-pressed to get to 180 bushels per acre, which is what USDA estimated as of August 1. But nonetheless, when you look at the numbers, they are there. And we did see a crop that matches up very, very well with the crop that we saw a year ago.
This year, the Pro Farmer Crop Scouts found the biggest changes in the Nebraska crop were in quality in the northeast and southeastern districts.
And what we saw in northeast Nebraska was a really good corn crop. The irrigated corn was really good. The dryland corn was a touch better than what it was a year ago. So I think what we lost in southeast Nebraska this year compared to a year ago, we probably picked up in northeast Nebraska. And when I say northeast and southeast, I'm just dividing it by the Platte River.
With 199 corn samples under their belts, Pro Farmer estimates the Nebraska corn crop will average 158.29 bushels to the acre. Of course, they were looking at soybeans as well. Chip Flory says there's a big potential for the state's soybean crop.
This is the third week of August. It's supposed to be dry. And when it is not dry in Nebraska, and we've got the number of pods that we've got in Nebraska this year, we're up from a year ago. you better not underestimate what that bean crop can do.
Pro Farmer estimates the Nebraska soybean crop will produce about 1,306 pods in a 3-foot by 3-foot square area. That's an increase of 5.4% over a year ago and 11.4% over the last 3 years. Last year, Nebraska produced the highest yielding soybean crop in the nation, averaging 54.5 bushels to the acre. Let's move to the eastern leg of the Pro Farmer Crop Tour. Of course, it's sponsored by Pioneer Hybrid, and the first thing that scouts noticed as they crossed the state line into Illinois was that they weren't seeing the big bin buster type of crop that they were used to seeing in the land of Lincoln. Pioneer agronomist Mike Helmer lives right here in Champaign County, and he explains why that's the case.
Eastern Illinois, that's probably my driest area. Now, we got the crops in good, had good moisture. We actually had too much moisture early on. Then we had pretty good pollination, and then it got hot and dry. And so during the grain fill period is when we really started having a lot of stress. So it really hurt us on yield, especially on that 136 corridor there. Now, we got other areas south of us that had some timely rains, not a lot. But I don't think you're going to see a bend buster crop in East Central Illinois this year by any stretch of the imagination.
Illinois soybeans are a different story, however. Some of the best-looking beans on the tour so far were right across the road from the struggling corn crop.
We're in good shape with beans. In fact, we had a little bit of scattered showers here the last couple days, which will put on more yield on these beans. We'll fill them out at the top and their branches, those pods. We usually will lose those pods if we don't get moisture. Now, coming in here tonight, also we got some moisture in the atmosphere. Hopefully we'll get some rains out of that. I think our beans can still make use of that rain. So I think we're still set up to have a pretty good bean year.
The Pro Farmer Midwest Crop Tour continues through western Illinois today and into Iowa midweek. By the end of the week, all those numbers will be in, and Pro Farmer will massage them for their national averages. Chip Flory will join us on Commodity Week. You can hear that online at willag.org or on many of these radio stations. Just look for Commodity Week.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Let's switch gears now from this year's crop to last year's crop. Many producers that signed up for the Acre program are wondering just how that might pay out this fall. I've got some of the answers from Gary Schnitke. Acre stands for Average Crop Revenue Election. It's a program the U.S. government has been live testing, for all intensive purposes, with farmers around the nation. The program makes payments based on lack of revenue. University of Illinois Farm Management Specialist Gary Schnitke has been tracking the projected payouts the farmers in Illinois might receive for the last year's harvest.
Right now, acre payments, state acre payments, we're projecting somewhere between $18 and $19 average acre payment on corn. That's come down here recently because of higher prices during the later part of the marketing year. Soybeans, no payment, and wheat will be a large payment, and we're projecting that in the $70 plus planted acre range for Illinois for the 2009 crop.
Schnitke has used the U of I's crop budget projections, which can be found on the FarmDoc website at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu, to look ahead to this year's harvest and potential acre payments to be received in the fall of 2011, too.
Yeah, we would still be projecting payments for wheat. We would be projecting modest payments for corn, given what's happened to prices here recently. Acre payments looked more likely in May of this year for the 2010 crop than they do now, given where the price levels are at right now.
Now, that's due in large part to a poor growing season in Russia and parts of the Black Sea grain belt. Drought there may have cut the coarse grain harvest by more than 15%. It means corn and other grains will be in higher demand around the globe to make up for the Black Sea shortfall, and that the higher prices will effectively eliminate acre payments for the U.S. crop to be harvested this fall. for University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It is a Wednesday afternoon. The folks at the Anderson's Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana, always join us to talk about the agricultural cash grain market. Matt Kunisch is on the line with us today. Matt, thanks for being with us today.
No problem.
Can you tell me about cash grain in your area? Has there been any movement in the last week?
Very little. It's slowed up quite a bit. Basis levels continue to weaken up a little bit in this area. The new crop stuff is looking like it's going to be possibly 3 weeks away. Sitting up here at the ethanol plant, we still have quite a bit of inventory that we still need to get through. The problem, obviously, is just getting the good clean corn in to blend any damage out with, but that's just not going to be happening here in the next 3 weeks. So
you've got a fairly wide basis, I suppose. That's to hold the old crop stuff that's not in good shape out. You expect it to get better as we get to harvest? Will you be in need at that point in 3 weeks?
I think everybody's in need in this area. It's not that. It's just there's enough coming to market early where most rail loaders in the area that are holding on to a quantity of damage are comfortable enough getting there and being able to blend that out. The only problem, foreseen in the future here is the ability to get cars in a timely manner so you can blend that out.
How much of a problem? I suspect that the early harvest is very good for those who have corn to blend out, you being one of them, and most, I suspect, is the case. How much of a logistical problem do you think it will be to get that on rail cars out of the way to get the bulk of the harvest, especially if it's a big one, back into your bins?
It's going to be very difficult. Depends on, if there's half the state that runs the same weekend, it's going to be a nightmare. If there's areas that get rain and their crop gets held off for a couple days, that could ease it up a little bit. But overall, it's going to be difficult no matter which way you look at it. I wouldn't compare it to last year with the moisture issues, but it will be similar. Facilities will be closed if rail cars aren't placed on time.
Tell me about soybeans.
Beans right now, bean basis is weakening up a little bit. Same thing. Everybody's coming in to harvest. Looking about 2.5 to 3 weeks away in this area. Most processors have either taken or are taking downtime right now, fixing up the plant. There are some little bit of bean movement, guys cleaning up stuff out of their bins, but for the most part, pretty quiet. Everybody's just waiting for the new crop.
Your bids for the day?
Currently, Climbers Corn at 403 and Delphi Beans at 1067.
Thanks much, Matt.
Thank you.
Matt Kunisch is with the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a look at the agricultural weather forecast with Drew Lerner.
Lerner Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Lerner Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
It's National Ice Cream Pie Day. The Eskimo Pie, America's first chocolate-covered ice cream bar, was invented by Christian Kent Nelson in 1920. The inspiration was a boy making a purchase at Nelson's confectionery store. The boy started to buy an ice cream cone, but then changed his mind and instead purchased a chocolate bar. Nelson asked the boy why he did not buy both. The boy's reply, "I wanted them both, but I only have a nickel." Thus the inspiration for Nelson's creation of sticking melted chocolate to frozen ice cream. On this day in agricultural history in 1850, Henri de Balzac died, a French author. He would lock himself away during creative bursts, drinking coffee and eating only fruit and eggs. And when he finally took a break, he was known to consume huge quantities of food. One report recalls that once he consumed at one sitting 100 oysters, 12 cutlets of salt meadow mutton, a duck with turnips, 2 partridges, and a Normandy sole, not to mention the desserts, fruit, and liquors he finished up with. And in 2004, it was reported that it rained fish at about 2:30 in the afternoon in Shropshire, Western England. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City is with us to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Start right here in the Midwest. It has been a beautiful few days. What can we look forward to?
Well, pretty much more of the same. I can't get too excited about any real substantial amount of moisture, but, you know, beautiful is one thing, and meeting crop needs is another. We still have dryness in the lower parts of the region and in the easternmost parts of the Midwest as well, and both of these areas still need a significant amount of moisture, and it's not in the offering at the moment, not in the first week of the two-week outlook. There will be a few showers. I don't want to imply it will be absolutely dry, but the amount of rain that will be falling across the region will be far short of what is really required in order to fix the low soil moisture in parts of Indiana, for instance, and southeastern Illinois. And we have an increasing amount of drying that's taking place in Ohio and Michigan as well. So a lot of this region really does need some rain, and it's not in the pipeline at the moment. The midday models, though, came out today and suggested that perhaps a better opportunity for rain would develop when we got out beyond about the 26th of August. So maybe in the last few days of August, or more likely in the very very early days of September, maybe there would be a better chance for rain. But you know as well as I do that forecast model data that gets that far out in the forecast doesn't verify very well. So we're going to have to sit back and watch real closely. Right now, the tendency here in this first week of the outlook is definitely a declining one for crop conditions in the east.
And tell me about those dry areas, what they look like at this point, where they might be, and how dry they are.
Well, we are running very short on topsoil moisture from central portions of Indiana southward into the southwest corner of that state, and then it also extends a little bit into Kentucky, and it also goes into the southeastern corner of Illinois as well. Now, there's some other areas that are dry in and around that region, but those are the areas that really stand out at the moment as having the biggest issue. Subsoil moisture isn't completely depleted, of course, in those areas, and crops are still hanging in there in somewhat of a development mode here. But as we move forward through this next 7 days, we're probably going to see more temperatures in the lower and middle 90s, and that is likely to increase the stress levels and further deplete that moisture situation, putting these crops in a more serious environment. The odds are real good that places like Ohio and Michigan will see a further decline in soil moisture. They are not hurting like central and southwestern Indiana is at the moment, but they could very easily turn drier as we move forward through this period of time. Won't be quite as hot in those states, and it also isn't quite as dry in the subsoil, so it's not quite the critical issue that it might be a little bit further to the southwest in Indiana.
As late as last week, the Western Corn Belt on the flip side, awfully wet. Do they remain that way, or have they begun to dry out just a bit?
Well, I think we'll do a little bit better for a little while. It's not going to be dry in the sense that it just quits raining in that region, but the intensity of the storms that come across the region will probably lighten up a little bit. And so we'll maintain a moisture abundance there, but maybe get away from some of the flooding that's been occurring here recently. Now, I say that knowing full well that there's going to be a couple of rounds of severe thunderstorms over the next two or three nights in the upper parts of the Midwest, including the eastern Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and parts of Iowa. So that region will definitely stay wet. As far as having worsening floods, though, I don't think that'll be the case. And after that passes, we'll see an improvement take place.
Drew, thanks so much.
Have a great afternoon.
Hey, you too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm Todd Gleason. Stay with us, if you can, for the Farming World. This is the Farming World News and Information from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I am Todd Gleason. In studio with us this afternoon, Joe Spencer, entomologist from the Natural History Survey, located right here in Urbana-Champaign on the University of Illinois campus, to talk about many things, mostly about the western corn rootworm. But, Mr. Spencer, let's start with Agronomy Day, which kicks off at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. You're going to spend the whole day in the field, or a good portion of it, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And what do you do?
My student Sarah Hewson and I are going to be talking about rootworm movement and mating behavior in refuge and transgenic corn.
Oh, my. You're going to talk about mating behavior. So you've got a long history of watching rootworms and how they mate, don't you?
Yes. It's commonly known that we like to watch in my lab. We spent the summer observing how these insects move and the frequency with which we find pairs of beetles in the field. And we're trying to get an idea about how different configurations of refuge and transgenic corn affect the mating activity of these insects.
Let's go back and do a little history on the rootworm so people know why it is that you study this animal. It is an insect. It's been around for a very long time in cornfields in the United States.
Right. In fact, the pest history of the western corn rootworm goes back to the early 1900s. They were first a pest in Colorado, and then with the advent of corn farming pushing out into the Great Plains, the rootworms found a ready highway to move east, and they made it to Illinois in 1964. And since that time, they've been a pest problem. And initially, the insects were controlled with insecticides. And however, we'd known for a very long time that because of the females' fidelity to cornfields for egg laying and the need for the larvae to develop on corn roots, that we could manage these insects very effectively if we just rotated corn with another crop. In Illinois, that was soybeans. And while it took a while for crop rotation to really become adopted in the state, by the mid-1980s, Extension had really scored a victory, and we had moved away from a lot of dependence on insecticides, and crop rotation was one of the preferred methods for managing these insects. And things worked great. However, right about that time, there was the beginning of some hints that there might be a problem with crop rotation. If we go back and look at some of the early data collected by some extension entomologists on campus, Kevin Steffi, Mike Gray among them, we see the beginnings of unexpected injury in rotated corn in Illinois. And it wouldn't be until the mid-1990s when one of my colleagues at the Natural History Survey, Eli Levine, was called out to a rotated corn field that was kind of flat. And the question was, what caused this to happen? After some pretty extensive studies and examinations, Eli determined that this wasn't caused by some other pest. It was rootworm beetles, and they must have been laying eggs in the soybean fields the year before.
That was an amazing event. I spent some time in the field with Eli in that year, and the center of this is right here in East Central Illinois. It wasn't very far away.
Right. It was up in near Piper City. We sort of refer to that as the epicenter of resistance to crop rotation.
Okay, so we're used to insects, hearing about insects adapting to control methods, not generally to crop rotation or what we'd call a cultural control method, but they're pretty adaptive if you spray them mm-hmm. with an insecticide. Mm-hmm. Some of them will live because they tend to have so many generations so quickly, whether that's in a year or over a period of years. And there are so many insects. Mm-hmm. They adapt fairly quickly, but this happened in kind of a different way. This was something entirely, I don't know whether it was entirely new, but it certainly was different than what entomologists were used to seeing.
Right. It was sort of felt that crop rotation might be sort of an unbeatable control. I mean, we exploited what we thought was a biological feature of these insects that could not be overcome. However, when we put something out over a vast area and put selection pressure on insects over time, natural selection rears its ugly head, and what we did was selected for a difference in behavior. And beetles that had once been that had strong fidelity to cornfields began to be a little bit less choosy with where they laid their eggs. And we rapidly selected for females that were not picky where they laid their eggs. And that's what created resistance to crop rotation due to this behavioral adaptation.
Yeah, so what had happened is that these insects would be in the cornfield and they simply wouldn't leave. They'd lay their eggs in the cornfield. And those eggs would hatch the following year, and they would find a soybean root because crop rotation instead of a corn root, and they'd all die.
Yes, but there's always a few individuals and populations that we might call oddballs, and the individual females that had less fidelity, who maybe laid a few eggs when they were outside of a cornfield, those were the females that survived under strict crop rotation. And over a period of about 20 years, we took a population of rootworms that stayed in corn and turned it into a population of beetles that would go outside of corn to lay their eggs.
Did this happen anywhere else in the Midwest beyond Piper City to begin with?
Initially, we think it was in the single area in Piper City. And over a period of several years, it spread. By 1995, it was disastrous over east central Illinois and west central Indiana. And it has now spread all the way into Iowa, as far north as into Wisconsin and Michigan. It's really spread across the Corn Belt now, and it's moving west.
Was there a separate population, and I'm just not familiar enough, other than I've seen some of it, up in the northwestern or northeastern corner of Iowa, was there a separate population, do you know, that developed? There was some thought that it might have been, but that they may have been transferred in as well.
I think any of the insects that have developed resistance to crop rotation that we find spreading out have probably originated from this area. And those insects in northeast Iowa could probably be traced back to an Illinois origin and ultimately this field in Piper City.
Tell me why it is that they move so quickly to the east but not to the west.
Well, it has to do with the weather and the way weather fronts move through this part of the Midwest. We typically get summer storms that will come from the southwest, move towards the northeast, and in the evenings, the rootworm beetles like to take flight, and that happens to be a time when thunderstorms go through, and they literally are sucked into the updrafts, into a thunderstorm. They can be carried tens of miles until they're rained out somewhere downwind from where this storm started out. And under these conditions, there were times when rootworms by the billions would wash up along the shores of Lake Michigan. And we know they didn't swim out into the middle of Lake Michigan. They were carried out there in a thunderstorm.
How do you know that they move like this?
Well, the fact that we can find rootworms washed up in heaps along the shore of Lake Michigan tells us that they were up there. But several years ago, we also conducted studies where we erected tall scaffolding towers out in the fields, and we caught insects as they were leaving our cornfields. And we would catch them in nets and measure the rate at which they were flying. There were some years in the late 1990s when you probably could have caught flying rootworms with a bucket just as well as an insect net.
Now, these scaffoldings were pretty interesting. There's I think in the Lost 40, which mm-hmm. is one of the agronomy farms. It's on outside of Urbana. You erected a scaffolding there and you sat there for hours.
We would. There was one study where we collected insects every hour during the daylight time, but I would happily spend 3 or 4 hours up there in the evening, 40 feet off the ground with a bug net, and it was a lot like being an outfielder on a baseball team because you'd peer into the setting sun and you could see the rootworms coming and swing your insect net at them. And at one point in 1997, they were coming through so thickly it looked like a snow flurry as the low angle of the sun reflected off all these rootworm wings.
And what were you looking at once you got hold of them? How could you tell? What was the difference between one that liked corn and probably stayed in corn and one that liked soybean?
Well, we couldn't tell the difference between them. But what we were interested in looking at that time was the magnitude of this movement. We were very interested in trying to understand how the spread of these insects might be occurring so fast. And when we could collect, you know, hundreds of insects in 10 minutes, 40 feet off the ground, we knew there was a lot of aerial movement, and it was moving off to the northeast. And that explained why the beetles went east so quickly, and it took them quite a while to move to the west. And now they're, you know, just now moving into probably central Iowa.
And then now let's fold that into to your current research and what you're going to talk about tomorrow morning on the South Farms during Agronomy Day.
Well, this is at the complete opposite end of the scale of movement, because now I'm interested in how these insects move to find mates. And the reason that's important is that transgenic corn, which is an extremely effective method for managing these insects, is also at risk of resistance. And the way we avoid resistance in this case is we're counting on beetles from refuge, which is non-transgenic corn, to find their way into the transgenic corn and mate with any potentially resistant insects. With a big population of refuge insects, they effectively can dilute resistance in transgenic corn. And we're trying to understand how rapidly the males can find a female in transgenic corn. And indeed, are the pairings that we find in these fields matings between males from refuge and females from transgenic corn or something else?
Yeah, so we need to be clear, because the resistance here is not the cultural
right. This
is crop rotation resistance. And we haven't yet found the golden, what you entomologists have referred to since the beginning as the golden child, or the one the one rootworm, or the one European corn borer, either one, which would be resistant to the BT genes that are inserted into
right.
the corn hybrids.
That's right.
To control them.
Right.
So resistance in this case is to the genetic modification.
Right. And we don't have resistance in the field that we know of, but what we're studying is the behavior of these insects so that we can incorporate this into models, predictive computer models that will help us avoid resistance. If we know how far the insects can move and their mating characteristics and their habits, we can then feed that into models that tell us the best ways to deploy refuge to avoid resistance.
So tell me again what it is you're doing. How are you doing this research?
We are going out into cornfields that we have planted with different percentages of refuge. We have block refuges of 5% and 20% non-transgenic corn in transgenic corn field. And we also have a 5% seed blend where we have refuge and transgenic corn mixed together. And then we have a control field that has no refuge. And we go out at regular intervals across these fields and catch beetles that are flying around, and we also look for mating insects. And this fall, we'll be analyzing those insects.
And in those that are mixed, why did you choose the 5%?
We chose 5% because this is a percent refuge that I think is likely in the future for managing rootworm beetles. Already, SmartStax corn has a 5% refuge. Seed blends in the future, maybe 5%. This just seemed like this was a wise percentage to test.
Stay with us. We'll come back and we'll talk more about the Western corn rootworm with you and some things that might be happening in the future. Joe Spencer is an entomologist with the Natural History Survey right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You're listening to The Farming World. Back in 2 minutes.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, Mexico's retaliatory tariff on U.S. pork exports will be set at 5% as the country tries to increase pressure on the U.S. to end a long trade fight. Mexico says it is adding new products, including pork, to a list of U.S. goods subject to tariffs because of a U.S. failure to allow Mexican trucks to circulate on U.S. roads as part of the NAFTA trade deal. U.S. agribusiness and trading giant Cargill says that its quarterly earnings more than doubled, with all five of its main global business segments posting profits. Cargill reported net earnings of $691 million for the fiscal fourth quarter that ended on May 31st. That's up from $327 million a year earlier. Excluding earnings from its majority stake in fertilizer maker Mosaic Company, earnings rose 87% to $433 million. China's state stockpiler Sinograins says that China's corn reserves are down sharply compared with last year, making it more difficult for the government to control corn prices. All of China's corn reserves stored in 2008 have been sold. China will hold another corn auction on Friday, the second sale this week. The central government on Tuesday reduced the volume offered in the Northeast to 400,000 tons from 1 million tons. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has filed a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency that, after the agency rejected the chamber's challenge to the 2009 endangerment finding, the basis for EPA regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. And that's a look at today's business news.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to The Farming World. This is a production of Illinois Public Media. In studio with us this afternoon to talk about the Western corn rootworm is Joe Spencer. He's an entomologist at the Natural History Survey right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. Joe, when we last talked with you just a couple of minutes ago, we had taken up your current work and what that really means in terms of resistance development, or I'm trying to keep resistance from developing right in the Western corn rootworm. Why is it important that that happens?
Well, it's important because transgenic rootworm protection has sort of become sort of the new gold standard for managing these pests. And our options for managing rootworms using other types of tools have diminished. In East Central Illinois, crop rotation isn't very effective, so that's kind of off the table. Soil insecticides are still out there, but many farmers have gone to planting equipment that isn't quite so easy to use with soil insecticides, and the central hopper units for planting corn also make this a little bit more difficult. So we've got transgenic corn. It's a very effective product, and we'd like to preserve its utility for as long as we can.
Let's talk about the insect itself, because when the surveys are done in the fall, and usually this is with the European corn borer, but not right, the Western corn rootworm, right, the numbers for the corn borer, which is also controlled in the same way, mm-hmm, by a BT or genetically modified, mm-hmm, crop, are really, really low. Are the Western corn rootworm numbers low too?
Western corn rootworm numbers are getting low. For the last 3 years, we've had very low populations. However, in all three of those years, we can look back to some conditions, wet conditions in the spring at egg hatch during 2009 and 2008. This year, we had standing water in the field at the time when a lot of these beetles were just about to emerge as adults, and so that knocked back the populations. But we can also look and see what I think is a general population decline suppression of rootworms that may be due to really broad adoption of transgenic corn. I don't think the rootworms are going away anytime soon, but these populations are dropping, and the beetles are getting more and more scarce. This is the first year since I've lived in Illinois that I haven't found a corn rootworm beetle in my yard at some point during the summer. And the game is just about up for rootworms this year. Corn is starting to mature, and once those kernels start to harden, there's nothing left for rootworms to feed on. And I expect if we get some warm conditions and a little rain, disease will kick in and kill whatever rootworms are left in the field here in in a couple of weeks.
I suppose there's good news and bad news in that. The good news is they're not around. The bad news is they're not around to some extent, I think.
Right.
And right?
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a different face I have to put on depending who I'm talking to. When I'm talking to growers, they're excited that rootworm beetles are kind of going down in their numbers. But as an entomologist and a biologist who really is fascinated with these insects, I'd like to see a few more beetles, at least in my study fields. We'll have to see what kind of trends develop as we move forward.
A producer's been asking you if it's okay not to put a transgenic crop in?
This is a point that often comes up. I have heard growers talking about this. It raised the question, you know, we don't have very many rootworm beetles. Should I be using a transgenic? Does it really pay? Last year, we monitored beetle abundance in a number of commercial growers' fields. We didn't have beetles in soybeans that would have suggested significant injury this year. So the question is, does it pay to plant transgenic corn when you don't have rootworms? Well, there's some mitigating factors, and the fact that there's superior genetics and agronomic traits that are very desirable in these flagship hybrids that are rootworm transgenics kind of pushes growers to using these for reasons other than pest control.
Yeah, well, since there's broad adoption, and how broad is it now? It actually, out of the last USDA reports, it's an enormous number of acreage.
I think it was 84% of corn grown in Illinois is a stacked hybrid of some sort.
Does that present its own problem?
As long as growers are planting the refuges they're supposed to plant, then we don't have a problem. If we don't plant refuges, if we don't respect these refuges, then we set ourselves up for some problems. That's where resistance comes in. And what I imagine will be an eventual move towards seed blends will eliminate the problem of compliance because the refuge will be in the bag, as they say.
The refuge will be in the bag. Okay, now let's go back to tomorrow. Agronomy Today kicks off at 7 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. You're on which tour?
I'm on Tour D.
You're on Tour D.
Which is, I think it's a mostly entomology tour.
All right. So Tour D, that'll be the last tour to depart. And I start filling wagons at 7 a.m. So if they want to go see you first, I would guess that I'll send your first wagon out at about 7:25 to 7:30. Those first set of wagons, actually, so you could arrive a little late is what I'm telling you if you want to, because I'm in charge there, relatively speaking, I suppose. And they'll come out. What else do you know that they'll find out on that entomology tour? Did you look at it?
I looked at it, yes. So a graduate student that I work with, Andy Morehouse, is going to be talking about Japanese beetles.
Excellent.
Mike Gray is going to be reporting on the results from the U of I standard trials, talking about smart stacks, reduced refuge, resistance management. Rick Weinzerall is going to be talking about monitoring for, I think, corn earworm. I'll be talking about refuge beetles, along with my graduate student, Sarah Hewson, and Darren Eastburn. I'm not sure what Darren was talking about, but he's the fifth stop on our tour.
All right. That's just one of four different tours. They all take about an hour. They're all at Agronomy Day. You can come out tomorrow. It's free. If you want to buy a meal, of course, that's fairly cheap, and it's a good meal
at noon
hour. And come out and visit with Joe tomorrow. And